Where are we now? Well, I'd like to start by reading a quote from Mr. Armstrong from The Wonderful World Tomorrow, because it sums it up very, very succinctly. 6,000 years of human experience has brought mankind to the very brink of world suicide. The world's leading scientists and statesmen say the only hope now is world government. And as a matter of interest, aren't they trying very, very hard to bring this about? And aren't they having very, very, very little success? I attended the San Francisco conference in 1945, where world leaders attempted to form a world organization of nations. They called it the United Nations. There I heard chiefs of state ring out the warning that this was the world's last chance. But it has failed. The United Nations has no power over the nations. It has no power to settle disputes, stop wars, or prevent wars. The so-called United Nations are not united. This effort has degenerated into a sounding board for communist propaganda. Man has failed his last chance. Now God must step in or we perish. That's what he said. And he wrote that 40 odd years ago, strangely enough. And here we are today, and that might as well have been written yesterday. Well, what I'd like to do today, this is a sermon in two, it's a budget sermon, it's only got 2 points. What will our inheritance look like? You know, Matthew 5:5 says that we inherit the earth. Okay. So what's it going to be like? What's our inheritance going to be like? And the second point, basically, is what are we going to do with it? So let's start off and just turn to Revelation 6. Now, what I want to do is I want to run through some of the prophecies as to the things that are going to happen. And perhaps by the time I'm finished with that section, you'll have a rough idea of the raw material with which we will have to work. I might start by saying the word earthquake. I think I have mentioned this before, but the word earthquake is in Greek seismos. It doesn't just mean earthquakes. It means any great upheaval. It can be anything from an earthquake, a tempest, a volcano, a meteor strike. And talking about tempests, on the news this morning, the Philippines again seems to be experiencing difficulties. Mr. Monroe was talking about water. Well, I'll tell you what, they've got plenty of it there. In fact, they've got so much of it, they're up to their necks in it, quite frankly. So we must keep the people in the Philippines in our prayers. Let's go to Revelation 6, and let's just start off here and see what we're actually going to inherit. Revelation 6, verse 12, "And I behold, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood." Now, that does not sound like an earthquake. An earthquake can cause a lot of damage, and it raises a bit of dust, but that's not what an earthquake tends to do. This sounds more like the discharge of a rather large volcano. Now, to give you an example, in 1883, Krakatoa erupted near Java. The eruption ejected approximately 21 cubic kilometers of rock and ash and pumice. I don't think we can even, that's just a mountain, literally a mountain, a big mountain. Average global temperatures fell by as much as 1.2 degrees Celsius in the year following. Weather patterns continued to be chaotic for years, and temperatures did not return to normal until 1888. The harvests were very, very poor. Some countries actually experienced what was bordering on famine. The resulting tsunami from this effect, because what happened at Krakatoa, for those of you who don't know, it was basically a volcano on an island. And the volcano went straight down into the sea on both sides, deep. And when this thing went, you can imagine what happened to the sea. Well, the sea rushed in to fill the void, landed on top of hot lava, and we had a sort of a large tsunami. Not like the 20 feet or so that hit a few years back and killed several hundred thousand people. This tsunami reached a height of around about 140 feet. And they tend to travel at 300 to 400 miles an hour. Now, if you can imagine a wall of water 140 feet high, traveling at, say, 400 miles an hour, hitting a building, the foundations even can be washed away. It drowned approximately 36,000 people. You've got to remember in these days they didn't have the internet and the telephones and the radios and the televisions. So a lot of this is basically gathered by government officials. But it seems that around about 36,000 people died. If the same thing happened today, the death toll in that area would be in the millions. When the tsunami reached Aden, which is 12 hours after the explosion, it was still 60 feet high. Aden is 3,800 nautical miles from Krakatoa. The dust cloud completely encircled the equator within 2 weeks. That was a very ordinary volcano. Now you can start squirming. Early signs, this is from the India Times website. I'm going to read it as they say it. If you want to add yourself an Indian accent, it's lovely the way they express themselves. This is their very succinct headline. Early signs of megavolcano in Sumatra, very close to where the tsunami happened, dash, it can be devastating to the human civilization. Nice long headline. It says the recent series of volcanoes in that area have increased the level of alarm. Some of the quakes, mistaken as aftershocks, were in fact harmonic tremors, signifying lava movement. What you have in that area is you have the two plates, and the one plate is going under the other, but it's got a pressure point. And as that plate is going down, this rock is melting as it hits the magma, and it's got nowhere to go. So you see what's happening? It's going down, and it's pushing and pushing, and as it goes in, it melts and creates more magma. And this pool of magma is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is what these people are worried about. It says, there's an eruption that happened many years ago in Toba, which is in the same area. It says, if that were to take place, it can bring the human civilization to its knees. That has the potential of 3,000 cubic kilometers of an eruption. 21 cubic kilometers was Krakatoa. We're talking here 3,000 kilometers, right? This can be so devastating that Earth may experience a drop in temperature of some 30 degrees Fahrenheit, and that would last for many years because it would blot out the sun. The volcanic activities in the regions in the past week may be signaling an imminent mega volcano. One interesting fact is that this area is just on the opposite side of the globe from the Yellowstone National Park, which is not a volcano. It is a caldera. That is, a volcano is a fissure in the rock, and you get this pool of magma, and it's squeezed up through a thin tube. And the earth gives a hiccup and goes, and out it comes. A caldera is 20 kilometers long in this case, 14 kilometers wide, and if that goes up, then exit the United States of America, because it would be 3,000 cubic kilometers of mess would be nothing compared to what would happen. And that's only one of several large calderas which they are monitoring. Yellowstone is tipping. There are lakes in Yellowstone where at the one end the bed is up in the air and the other the trees are underwater. They are monitoring it very, very closely. And it has been noticed, in fact I remember one of the things Philip brought up, I think he was actually at school at the time, and somebody had been discussing the fact that when you get earthquakes, you often get a reciprocal thing on the opposite side of the earth. The whole earth is basically magma in the middle, apparently. I say apparently because, you know what, they don't really know. We know more about the moon than we do about the middle of the earth. Yes, they're professing themselves to be wise, but, you know, we don't know a lot. We can't cure the common cold if we don't know what electricity is. And they're kind of basic things, aren't they? So that's a mega volcano. It says, if a mega volcano happens in Sumatra, it could be catastrophic to our civilization. The ashes will engulf the whole world, and serious repercussions on livelihood, agriculture, and weather. The last time this happened was several thousand years ago, but they reckon it knocked out 75% of every living being on the surface of the earth. That's how serious this is. Now, drop down to Revelation, it gets worse. That's just the beginning. Revelation 6, verse 13. Somebody said to me one day, you know, you're getting a bit like Jeremiah, and all you're bringing is bad news. You know, I look at the news, and all I see is doom and gloom. Do you know what? That's good. We don't want good news, because we're heading into a time of bad news. And the bad news is that that's the actual good news, because the worse the news gets, the nearer the end we are. So don't expect anything good to happen. But as I said the other day, we're aliens. We are observers. We are watching God work out his plan. And when you go through this, we finish going through this, you'll see what his plan is for this earth. And we're just starting here. Revelation 6, verse 13. And the stars of heaven fell onto the earth, even as a fig tree casts her untimely figs when she is shaken by a mighty wind. I don't think that takes any stretch of the imagination to see we're talking here about meteorites. We're talking about cosmic events. The whole solar system is going to somehow be shaken up. As we'll see in a minute, the earth does all sorts of funny gyrations. This is not just a little local thing that's going to happen in a local area. This is not just something that's going to happen on the earth. It's what's going to happen to the earth. And God says he is going to do it. So we have these meteor showers. If you go back, just make a note of Isaiah 34, verse 4. I'll just read it to you. It says, all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls off the vine and as the fig falls off the fig tree. Sounds like that's where this thing came in Revelation, doesn't it? Talking about vines and fig trees and so on. When you roll a scroll together, what happens? It goes. In other words, what this seems to be indicating in this particular instance is that the heavens are blotted out. And through those blotted out heavens, where you can't see the sun and the moon and the stars, come meteor showers. Now, I have seen, I have the privilege of seeing, one rather large meteor way back in the, I think it was the late 60s, early 60s, 61, 62, I think it was, down in South Africa. We saw a meteor come in, we're outside, and it came across the sky, and it came across a set speed like that, and it got across the sky about two-thirds of the way, and then it exploded, and we heard the noise. I actually heard the noise. And it broke into several parts, which went scattered all over the place. It's you know, you think of that, but you think of that, you being under that when it lands. It'd be terrifying if this suddenly appeared out of a dark, gloomy sky. What it would do to the people on the ground. No warning. No internet, no radio, no television, nothing. Out of a dark sky comes this lot. Pure terror. Revelation 6, verse 14. This adds, and the heaven departed as a scroll, when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island are moved out of their places. You see, this earth is roughly 8,000 miles in diameter. It's going to be shaken so much. The problem we have with Sumatra in that area, it's on the Ring of Fire. If you look at a plan of all the Earth's continental plates, these plates, the Ring of Fire sits in the middle there. And it is more or less a circle. But if something happens on that circle, what it can do at times is cause the circle to rotate slightly. So all around there, you're liable to get some sort of a reaction. That can then set off other plates, because they just float on magma. Revelation 8, verse 5. Just turn to Revelation 8 for a moment. Let's just see the adds a little bit there to the story. So we've now got the sky blotted out. We've got meteorites raining down. And Revelation 8, verse 5. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire out of the altar and cast it onto the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. Now, here again, this could be more volcanic activity. There were some fantastic photographs just recently in the papers of a volcano in Chile. And this man was just in the right place with his camera. And he photographed the electrical storm that happens. You can imagine this tremendous, powerful thrust coming out of the earth, the static electricity that created. And there was the most tremendous display of lightning, and obviously then thunder, in with the cloud. Revelation 8, verse 6, and the seven angels which are the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Verse 7, the first angel sounded, and there was hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of trees were burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. That cannot be ice-cold hailstones. Ice-cold hailstones would not burn up trees. Again, it's a cosmic event. It's got to be something coming out, traveling through the atmosphere at some ludicrous speed, red hot, hitting the ground and destroying one third of all the trees on the planet and all the grass. Verse 8, and the second angel sounded, and it was, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood. Again, it looks very much like that could well be some kind of a giant meteor. Think about what would happen if a decent-sized meteor landed in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The resulting tsunami would hit the western seaboard of the United States and South America, India, all that area in the Sumatra and all that area, across even into Africa. The devastation from the tsunami would be awesome. And it would cause the earth to shiver and shake a little bit, as we'll see. Verse 9 of Revelation 8. And a third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. One third of all sea life died. So it sounds like where this thing hits, that's where the damage obviously is done. And a third part of the ships were destroyed. See, the destruction here is on an awesome scale. We're not talking nuclear bombs now. We're talking God getting good and mad and sorting things out, you know, as he promised. Revelation 11. Let's go to Revelation 11. As I say, I'm sorry, it does not get any better. And it does make the fact that we might be hopefully living in caves, well away from tsunamis, I might add, it might not be quite a bad place to be. Revelation 11, verse 13. And the same hour was a great earthquake, and a tenth part of the city fell. And in the earthquake was slain of the men 7,000, and the remnant were affrighted and gave glory to the God of heaven. Now this looks like an earthquake, right? But why? They gave glory to the God of heaven. Why? What do you think the two witnesses have been going on about for 3.5 years? They've been giving it to these people in minute detail. And when they saw it happen, some of them would understand. Revelation 11, verse 19. And the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament, and there were lightnings, voices, thunderings, and a great earthquake and great hail. Here again, this could be an earthquake, but again, with the lightnings and the thunderings and the great hail, again, it sounds like some, more like some volcanic event, even linked with a cosmic event. Do you see what's happening to the earth? It's getting absolutely pummeled from all directions. If you want to turn back to Joshua, I'll look at an interesting scripture here. Because I know years ago I brought this up about this being a cosmic event, and I got absolutely clobbered because somebody said that what I was actually doing was trying to take the miracles of God and turn them into something physical. What is the physical? This lectern is made out of wood. If I could split the atoms in this lectern, it would probably take out the whole of this side of the earth. There is so much energy holding this lectern together. That's why we use atoms of uranium, because they're easier to split. Our own bodies are full of raw energy, power that we can't imagine, that hold our bodies together. The whole universe is like this. That's what God spoke, it all existed. He can do what he wants with it. If he wants a meteor shower, as we're going to see now, if he wants a meteor shower to land on an army in front of the Israelites and virtually totally destroy them, he can do it. And how does he do it? He just says it and it's done. And it happened. Joshua 10, verse 11. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and they were going down to Beth-horon, and the Eternal cast down great stones from heaven. And if you check the translation there, it talks of building blocks, lumps of rock, upon them, and they died. There were more that died by the hailstones than there were by the children of Israel that slew by the sword. And down to verse 12. Then spake Joshua to the Eternal in that day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. Joshua must have been some man. Do you know why he did this? Because God had told him to slaughter these people, and he was running out of day. He didn't have a night sight on his javelin or his bow and arrow, right? He wanted light. Verse 13. And the sun stood still and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves on their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down for about a whole day. On the other side of the earth, as a matter of interest, if you look into folklore and legends, all nations virtually have got the same story, only it's a long night. It's a long night. One of the islands, I remember reading at one stage, said that as the sun went down, a mouse came and ate the sun. And they had to have human sacrifices then to try and get the sun to come back. But the fact is, there was a long night. So if there was a long night on one side and a long day on the other side, what happened? Did the whole universe go rotating around? Or did God just not take the earth and spin it around flat? So the one face towards the sun. And of course the back obviously was in the dark for that period. And then it would settle back down again. This period is full of cosmic disturbances. Hezekiah, the sundial. The sun goes back 10 degrees on the sundial. How does that happen? That's a cosmic disturbance. You see, again, the evolutionists would have us believe that everything's been stable for millions and millions of years. That's hogwash. Mr. Armstrong, way back when I first went to college in 64, was saying, when we get to the moon, you'll see total destruction. When we get to Mars, you'll see total destruction. He said, if we get to any of the other planets, total destruction. Guess what? Total destruction. How did he know that? He understood Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Satan's battle. Joshua 10 verse 14 tells us something very, very interesting. It says, and there was no day like that before it or after it that the Eternal hearkened unto the voice of a man, and the Eternal fought for Israel. Joshua prayed, hold the daylight, I need to slaughter this lot. And God said, okay. God listened to his servant. And the Amorites didn't fare too well. And just when you thought it couldn't possibly get any worse, turn to Revelation 16. Revelation 16, verse 18 to 20. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake. Or to quote our late Mr. Saddam Hussein, the mother of all earthquakes. And so great, and the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, all of them, totally destroyed. Remember, this is right near the end of the 3.5 year period. And the great Babylon came in remembrance before God, and he gave unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. They really get it. Not a good place to be. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. This earthquake possibly will alter the whole surface of the earth. Every mountain and earth and island moved out of its place. You turn to, well, make a note of Joel 3. Joel 3 verse 16. The Lord also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. Two witnesses possibly. And the heavens and the earth shall shake. The heavens and the earth. A great cosmic upheaval. But the Eternal will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. If you want to go to Isaiah, turn to Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13, verse 13. You see, God is not joking. He said, therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place. What can that possibly mean? Well, quite simply, what it's saying is God is going to shake the heavens. From our point of view, our solar system, you know, the sun, Venus, Mercury, and on out through Mars and Jupiter and all that lot. It's all going to be shaken, and the earth is going to be removed out of its place. Its orbit is going to be moved, damaged, wobbled, whatever you want to call it. It says, in the wrath of the Eternal of hosts and the day of his fierce anger. God has had enough of all this. just as he had in the days of Noah and he destroyed the world with water, now he's doing it like this. Turn on Isaiah 24. Isaiah 24, verse 20. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgressions thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. The society that's on the earth at the time of this reeling to and fro is totally doomed. It's finished. Kaput. Finito. If you go back now to Revelation 6, you're getting the picture. We've got a planet here where the orbit has been disturbed. It's been bombarded by meteorites. All the continental plates are grinding and smashing into each other. There are volcanoes going off all over the place. There are earthquakes happening at very frequent intervals, not just tiny ones like the San Francisco one. I'm talking earthquakes that shake whole continents. The sky's gone dark. There's all sorts of horrible, nasty things going on. The earth is literally being pulverized. The amazing thing is that people, some people, will survive this. It says there's few men left. Go back to Revelation 6, if you will, because this is also interesting. And again, it proves the point that unless God changes a person's mind, they cannot accept what's going on. God has got to grant that turning, that repentance. It doesn't matter where we are. You know, John 6:44 stands. Revelation 6, verse 15. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondsman, and every free man, all of them, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountain, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? How do they know? How did they know this was the wrath of the Lamb? Well, it's quite simple. There are two witnesses there. Those two men are going to be very busy. Can you imagine how much they're going to rejoice when these two men are killed? That these two men are responsible. They will see that they're responsible. Though to a large degree, what they're doing is warning people, this is why it's happening. This is what's going to happen. Apart from, of course, they can cause droughts and plagues and all the other things that they can do. And Germany, center of the beast power. Isaiah 10, verse 19. God says up a special little treat for the Germans. He says, and the rest of the trees, bearing in mind that Germany is heavily forested to this day. You go through the Black Forest, you can drive for hours and hours and hours. It's beautiful, lovely place to drive. And the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, so few that a child may write them down. Total, total devastation. I don't know if you've seen a photograph of, was it the late 1800s or the early 1900s? There was this weird explosion over Russia, which they think was now in actual fact was a meteor that was ice. And as it entered the atmosphere with the heat, it changed into basically superheated steam. And there was literally just a blast on the earth. There was no actual lump of rock left. And it felled trees. And you can see photographs where the trees are all pointing out from the impact point. I forget how many million trees this thing destroyed. But you can imagine the landscape, you know, just mangled trees as far as you can see. That's what Germany's going to look like. Okay, I think we've got the picture. This world is going to be, in a mess. In a total mess. Cities destroyed. The sea, everything dead in the sea. No fish left in the sea. The sea's like blood. It stinks. All the ships are destroyed. Trees are destroyed. Grass destroyed. Continental plates moving around. I'd like to bring in one little thing here. And Dr. Hay mentioned this many, many years ago. And this is speculation, right? Speculation. In the beginning, in the Garden of Eden, the world could possibly have been one large continent. During the flood, which was nothing like a gentle rising and falling of water, it was again a humongous upheaval. During that flood, God wrenched that one continent apart, making it the world that we have today. Now, it sounds a huge undertaking, but you know, the shell of the earth is so incredibly thin. If you take something like a football and dip it in some water, the water that remains on the football just as a result of surface tension is way thicker in relation to the size of the football than the crust of the earth is. It's a simple matter to give it a good shake and split it all up. Further to that, you children can try this, by the way. If you can get a nice map that mum and dad say you can cut up. If you cut around all the big countries, cut them all up into separate pieces, and keep them in the position, and then slowly bring them in together, you will find they pretty much come together. They actually pretty much come together. As an example of the movement of these plates, and the fact that it wasn't something that happened over millions of years, it's something that happened very quickly and with tremendous power. Look at a map of India, right? India is just like a roughly a triangle. From the different types of rocks, they've worked out that India literally smashed into Asia, and it smashed into Asia so hard that it sent up the whole Himalayan mountain range. And you have the Andes, you have the Pyrenees, you've got mountain ranges all over the world where these huge plates crashed into each other, sending up. And the amazing thing is, you go to near the top of Mount Everest, and do you know what you find in the rocks? Seashells. You don't want to explain that one. In fact, most mountain ranges, you will find evidence of the fact that that was at one stage underwater. Because there just so happens to have been a flood, which nobody again wants to admit happened, because again, that seems too incredible for people to take on. So it could well be. Because you see, mountain ranges affect the weather. Mountain ranges affect the weather to a large degree, because they're cold at the top, the land's hot at the bottom, you've got wind circulation, you've got moisture, moisture goes up, falls as snow, and so on. And it creates a lot of the weather pattern that we have. In England, for those of you who've come from overseas, the reason, you listen to our weather forecast, and it's a joke, because it's so very rarely wrong. We've only spent about £150 million on a computer. Into that computer, they have fed all the actual forecasts that they've got going right back to the 30s and even 20s from the BBC, based on all the readings they get from all the weather stations they've got all around the Atlantic and north and into Europe and everything. And then they program into that what actually happened on those days when they forecast the forecast. So now what they do is, when they get a certain set of readings from all these stations they've got around the area, they put that into the computer. The computer then searches all the way through all this information and says, all right, on the 29th of June 1961, this was more or less the same, and this is what happened. And that's your weather forecast. That's fantastic. No, but it's fantastic. It's fantastic technology. The sad thing is, though, it's very rarely right. I mean, where we are, I mean, I've got up in the morning, gone downstairs, hit the computer on, hit the weather, and it said, today it's going to be sunny. Meanwhile, I opened into the conservatory we've got, and half of my garden's like flying off into the distance, and it's lashing with rain. Our weather's so fickle that when I take Sheila to school some mornings, in the 4 miles from our house, we can leave our house in sunshine, we can go through a heavy rainstorm, and get to the school, and it's dry. And one of the problems we've got is that because we're an island, we're surrounded by water. The temperature of the water is different on the North Sea from it is in the Atlantic. The Gulf Stream comes right up the middle, just to add a bit of confusion. We've got this great big European landmass down here. We've got the Arctic at the top, which is ice cold. We've got North Africa, Spain at the bottom, which is really hot. Then you've got the jet streams, which don't seem to have done what they're supposed to do this year, because all the weather systems have gone haywire, hence we've had such a wet summer. It's almost impossible to predict the weather in this country. But if we restore all things, Adam and Eve were put into a garden. And they didn't have any clothes. They were the first communists on the planet. They had no house, they had no clothes, they had one apple between the two of them, and they called it paradise. Yeah? But think about it, they were quite comfortable living in that environment. Now, if you restore all things, what do? If you take an old car and restore it, you take it back to what it was like, hopefully, when it left the showroom floor. Okay, so are we going to restore all things to that stage? Does it go back to being one massive continent? You see, it gets interesting. Are people going to die during the millennium? It's another question that's come up. Well, if we restore all things, then the answer is quite possibly no. They will probably live the 1,000 years. Because we're going to restore the world to what it was when it was created. And when it was created, men lived pretty much up to 1,000 years. Gets interesting now, doesn't it? By the time you get to 800 years into the millennium, you'll be able to trace all your ancestors going back. Could be good, maybe not so good. In the millennium, it's probably going to be all good. But if you're going to restore things, you're going to put them back to what they were. We'll come back to that a bit later as well. So tomorrow's world, let's get on to the good bit. Tomorrow's world. First of all, let's remember, first of all, this is Satan's world. This is Satan's world. Satan has designed a world where he can destroy mankind from off the face of the earth. That's what he wants. We are his competition. He must have a rough idea of God's plan. He can hear what's being said. He can see what Mr. Armstrong wrote. And he probably realizes he's trying to thwart that plan. That's what Satan's trying to do. Now, if you want to thwart God's plan, what you want to do is you want to create a society that you can literally turn off. You see, it's very difficult to create a famine in today's world. As long as everybody cooperated. Because all you do, you just stick stuff on jumbo jets and fly around the world and give people food where they need it. And we do that in some cases, to a large degree. The trouble is, we've also done it to a large degree, and the people there now just sit there and wait for the stuff to come and don't do any work at all. So that's backfired on us as well. We've created a supermarket society where everything comes to the supermarket. We have lettuce in farms around us. That lettuce is taken out of the ground, it's transported 150 miles, stuck in a plastic bag, labelled, normally a lying label that says its sell-by date is like a month away, packed with nitrogen, stuck under an irradiation machine that kills all the bacteria on it, keeps it nice and healthy, so it lasts longer on the supermarket shelf, and it drives another 150 miles back to our local supermarket, where we get lettuce grown in East Sussex. And it's already travelled 350 miles, been irradiated, stuffed full of nitrogen, stuck in a plastic bag. The plastic bags give off all sorts of funny gases which go into the food, and then we wonder why we're all sick. And that's just the lettuce. We won't bother going any further down that road. We then have the electricity problem. This whole setup here works on electricity. It is fantastic. I still find it rather weird that people say in the Philippines can be listening to this. People down in South Africa can be listening to this. And all we've got is a few microphones, a few boxes, a bit of wire and electricity. It's amazing. Especially when it works. But you see, more and more it works all the time. It is fantastic. When you come to Wales, if you've got a sat nav, it's marvellous. Turn left by the next dark street, boyo. Yes. But this society runs on oil. The oil is all pretty much, well, Americans have got a fair supply, but they've got so many environmentalists over there that they can't actually dig it out of the ground anymore, so they've got to buy it from the Arabs, which of course is basically, you know, a problem. That could be cut off quite quickly. It was cut off in this country a few years ago when a bunch of men that drove the tankers went on strike. Within 3 days, we had people pulling each other's hair out in the supermarkets, trying to fight for loaves of bread that had been made in the supermarket bakery. That happened in our little village, in quiet little countryfied England. Modern man could not survive, and here's the other problem we've got. Modern man cannot survive without all this junk. How many of you can go out without a mobile phone and feel dressed? Why? I have in my pocket all the time. I've got to be able to be contactable and I've got to be able to talk to people. Do I? Never used to have that. As I say, I've got the sat nav in the car. It's great, it's wonderful, it's marvellous. I always know where I am, even when I'm lost. Especially in London. That's great. You can go home and you don't have to go out and get a whole orchestra and a choir if you want to listen to Mendelssohn's Elijah or the Messiah. You just stick on a little plunky into a machine and hit a button and there it is in living stereo. When it comes to the work, we can get all Mr. Armstrong's material We can pump it out on the internet, and anybody, anywhere, as long as they can get the internet, can get what Mr. Armstrong preached. That could never happen in his day. Believe it or not, it could never have happened. But there's no place safe now from the Word of God, even China. People can get it if they want it. If God wants them to, wants to open their mind, they can get it. It's available. The problem is, turn off the oil, turn off the electricity, and within 3 days, people will be starving. In 7 days, people will be dying. In fact, within 24 hours, people in hospital on life support will be dying because the life support will be gone once the emergency generator is off. This whole society, Satan has designed so that he can turn it off. That's what he's designed. It's designed to fail. So, we start off with a world that's been totally destroyed, racked by earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanoes, meteorites, hail, the whole earth shaken and stirred. Literally. We will actually start with basically a blank canvas. Have you ever thought of that? A blank canvas. And out of all this, and it is truly amazing that some people will survive. The ones who are coming back to Israel will have been protected. The rest will have survived as far as they need to survive to work out God's plan. They will be other nations. But it says few men left. We start off with the people who are used to having all the wrong priorities. Flat screen television, computer, car, the latest mobile phone that does everything except make coffee, and they're working on that now. Yeah. I believe the latest mobile phones have got sat nav built into them. So, you know, you pick your phone up and say, where am I? And a map comes up and says, you know, you're here. But here again, that system can be used against you in a surveillance society, because not only do you know where you are, but they know where you are as well. Of course, they also know where you are when you use your credit card, when you make a phone call. We've often joked, I speak to Mr. Bowles, and sometimes we start speculating on the news a little bit, and he suddenly says, I wonder if somebody's listening to this. Chances are, it could well be. You see, that's another part of this society. Everybody's getting fearful because they don't know what to do now, because somebody's watching me. And yes, they are. All the people in Europe, all our details are on our computer. And that computer is in Europe and it's run by the Germans. Just a coincidence. The first thing we've got to do is establish proper priorities. Now turn to Isaiah 41. I always love it when this happens because you know you're on the right track. Thank you for the introduction to the sermon, Mr. Munro. On a physical level, mankind's basic needs are clean water, food, and shelter. We don't need cars, aeroplanes, ships, sat-navs, TVs, and all the other paraphernalia that this society has gifted us. But clean water? When we used to go to the feast in Southern Africa, we used to drive up from Durban. We did this several times. And we went right up into the Natal National Park to a place called Injusuti, which means solitude. And you drive about 30 kilometers off the dirt road. The dirt road is like 50 kilometers off the tar road. So you get the impression you're going into the bush. And then eventually you drive along for a part of the way along a riverbed between towering mountains. And you come into this clearing and there's a horseshoe of cottages. And behind that rises the monk's cowl, which from where you're standing is 8,000 feet. And you look up at this sort of angle to it. You feel like this big. The air is clean. And there's a big sign as you walk up, because you walk up the camp into the mountains, and there's a great big sign saying, from this point on, all water is potable. Especially water that comes out of the rocks. Right? So we were told about this, and the camp told us, if you go up, there's some Bushman paintings under this rock. So the family, another family we were with, the men, we had rucksacks on our back, and we had cheese and biscuits and red wine and crystal glasses all carefully wrapped up in a white tablecloth. And the women didn't know anything about this. And we had Granny with us as well, but she was a lot younger then. She was away in nearly 70. And we staggered up to this mountain, and we had to wade through several rivers of ice-cold, crispy, clear water, which you could drink. And eventually we got to these Bushman paintings, and there's this flat rock there, and we just placed the towel over it, and we put the crystal glasses up, and the bottles of wine, cheese and biscuits. And the children wanted a drink, and we said, okay, over there. And there's this rock with a little crack in it, and the water is just pouring out like a tap, pouring out into a little crystal clear pool, and it's shimmering in the sun there, under the rocks. And they went in there, and because they were real hot and sticky, and sloshed themselves, and they were drinking it. It's fabulous. But you can just walk out in the country and do that. You can't do that anymore. Our rivers are so polluted in England now because all the ladies are on the pill and those hormones end up in the water. They don't come out. They come right into the rivers. They don't go through the rough sewage that the processing doesn't take them out. The water that goes into the river is clean, but it's still got those hormones in it. So in English rivers, it's very difficult now to catch a male fish. Most of the fish are female. They've changed their gender because of the junk that's in the water. I might add that we can drink the same water. I wonder if this is perhaps one of the reasons we've got so many men today that are effeminate out there. Maybe it is. Maybe it's a result of us polluting the earth. We've certainly polluted it in so many ways that it's unbelievable. But let's get back to the good bit. Isaiah 41, verse 17. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongues fail for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in desolate heights, and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water, and the dry land springs of water. I will plant the wilderness, the cedar and the acacia tree, the myrtle and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the cypress tree and the pine and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Eternal has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. That's just been read before. Somebody said to me, you guys have goofed with the hymns, you know. I said, why? Well, how lovely are thy dwellings has been sung three times already, and that one about being old and grey has been sung twice already, and I make no apology. Do you know why? I'm repeating here. This was just quoted previously. God is in charge of what is said at the feast, and it starts on the first night. It was all about decisions, and people making right and wrong decisions brings us to where we are today, and it will take us right on until the world tomorrow. The people that make the right decisions will be the people that we work with here. The people that make the wrong decisions will come up at a later stage, but they'll still have a chance. The weather. Because the mountains will have departed, the weather systems will change. But it's not just that. You know, we've got climate change. I mean, not climate change, but global warming at the moment. Global warming is, I firmly believe, this is just me personally, my firm belief, what I've researched, global warming as such is a myth. It's a myth promulgated by the United Nations to drag tax from all the nations and to promote their cause of becoming a world government. That's not just my idea. That's the idea of a lot of people who study these things, right? But the problem is, here again, it's Satan, isn't it? It's that mixture of truth and error. We do have climate change. There is no doubt about the fact that climate is changing. We're having all sorts of weird weather all over the world. I mean, Philippines. A month's rain in 12 hours. And they get a lot of rain in a month. They get a lot of rain in a month. I mean, I remember in Africa seeing 3-4 inches of rain happen in 45 minutes. Saw a storm drain that was 25 foot deep and 25 foot wide. If you can imagine that, that's deep. I saw that fill up in 20 minutes. And it was a raging torrent for about 4 hours after the storm. That's water, but that's nothing compared with what they had in the Philippines. Nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. Pardon the pun. A drop in the bucket. So we need the weather to be changed. But you see, we're changing the weather, but we're not causing global warming. What we're doing is we're destroying the forest. We destroy, I say we, the world. We destroy in this world an area the size of Wales every year of rainforest. That rainforest is part of the lungs of the earth. The other part of the lungs, and by far the biggest part, something like 70 or 80%, are the oceans. They've now discovered that the whole Pacific Ocean is nothing more than a swirling mess of plastic. Because it's that circular area of sea. All the stuff, all the pollutants, all the plastic bags and cups and stuff from ships and everything, it all starts milling around in the doldrums. And it's breaking up in the sea, and it's reflecting light off and causing all sorts of problems, and it's killing the little microorganisms that create oxygen. You see, we are destroying the earth, and God says, I'll destroy those who destroy the earth. That's why the first part of this sermon. The people that live on this planet are trying to kill it because of the God of this world. It's a spiritual problem. It needs a spiritual solution. That's why Christ is coming back. Right, Mr. Monroe, take note. Millennial building regulations. Proverbs 24, verse 27. Turn to Proverbs 24, verse 27. You see, when you first look at the Bible, you think, there's not an awful lot in there about how we really do things in a millennium. I mean, where do you build? Well, if you look at some of the scriptures and have a little think about them, it does become a bit obvious. Proverbs 24, verse 27. At the beginning of the millennium, once the people have been through the process of being weeded out and they're put into their inheritance, they're going to inherit soil. Shaken, stirred, and turned over. And probably, I would guess, very fertile. Very fertile. Because I think that the soil was not that we have today, is nothing like the soil that was in the garden in Eden. Because that soil was perfect. Remember the bunch of grapes that the two spies brought back from a Gentile area before Israel moved in? That was a Gentile area. What's it going to be like when God's laws are in force? And the only real value, if you want to get into value, is soil. Because soil is where your food grows. And if you can grow a lot of food, then that soil is valuable. If you don't grow much food, it's not valuable. We don't think like that today, do we? At all this, keep in mind the purpose of the millennium. The millennium is 1,000 years to get this whole earth up to the standard of the Garden in Eden. And you know, you can prove that in one little scripture. And I've got it further on in my notes, but I'll just quote it now. It's in Luke. When Christ is dying and the two thieves are going at each other, and the one thief seems to get it a little bit. And Christ says to him, verily, verily, I say unto you today, comma, you will be with me in paradise. This man was not converted. This man will come up in the white throne judgment period, right? The white throne judgment period is paradise. That's what Christ said. That's how it's going to be. That's why it's going to take 1,000 years to get this whole world up to that standard. And if you think about it, if there's been 50 billion people that's lived up until the time of the end that will be resurrected, then the chances are that at the end of the 1,000 years, there will be 50 billion people on the planet. Because when those people are resurrected, they've got to be houses and crops and clothes and sheep and cows in the field and fruit on the trees. They will literally land in paradise. We cover this on the last great day. But by the same token, that's what the millennium's about. Getting the world into that state. Can you imagine how these people will react? And most of them died violent deaths. Life expectancy hasn't always been what we enjoy today. Even going back, 100 years or so, in even in England, some people, the average age of dying was 40, 45 years. Terrible. They will be resurrected into paradise. And we're going to be the kings and the priests that direct all this. So, something I want to try and do, trying to get the time. Kings and priests. Kings were expected to write out the first 5 books of the Bible. Why? Because it tells us how God thinks. It tells us God's way of life. And we'll go into that a little bit just now. All buildings must be built with this goal in mind. So when we start building in the millennium, those houses, those buildings, the civic buildings, or whatever we have, they have got to be designed to survive the 100 years at the end of the millennium. And you say, well, yeah, right. When my eldest boy was looking for a house some years ago, we went up to a place called Hertzman Zoo. And on the main road there, there's an old cottage. I swear there is not a straight line on any part of that building. It's all wattle and daub and lovely big old beams, and you've got to duck under the door, and in the bedroom, the beam over the bed was sort of like a bow, you know, and the floor was all uneven. Building was built before 1400. Still there. The local church was built before 1100. It was one of the first Norman churches in the country. That's at Pevensey, just down the road. You see? Churches stood for 1,000 years. Still a perfectly good building. It can be done, but you've got to get the regulations right. You see? Ezekiel 38, just turn to Ezekiel 38, we'll get a bit more about this. Ezekiel 38, verse 11, this is talking about Gog, the invasion by Gog and Magog. I'm not interested in that at the point, I'm interested in what it tells us here. It says, and you shall say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. They're going to attack Israel because it's the land of unwalled villages, totally unprotected. You know, if you go into some of the old cities in England, like York, for instance, you have a city wall, you have a castle, you have a keep. And the big boss lived in the castle, and all the peasants farmed all around the wall. But whenever there was danger, everything came inside. Gates got shut, we're safe. That was the way that their village was built. It was built as to preserve them. Not so in the millennium. Not so in the millennium. Completely different set of priorities. Because when Gog and Magog come up, God destroys them. God destroys them. The people then will have no need to worry about things like that. Proverbs 24:27 talks about when to build. See, it's time to build. It says, prepare the work without and make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterwards build your house. I think some of us perhaps have got this idea. No, in the early times when I was going over this, you kind of think, well, the beginning of the millennium, we are God, right? And maybe some of our children have come through this period. Because a lot of us have got children that might well have to go through the tribulation, come in, and then they see sense. When they're old, they will not forget the way they were taught. They knuckle under, they come into the beginning of the millennium, you think, all right, I'll build them a house. Yeah, we'll flatten and put a nice big lake over there and a river down here for them. And yeah, we'll just put a field of wheat there for them and a couple of dozen Welsh sheep there. Nope. Those people have got to build character. They're probably going to live in temporary shelters for a long time, because the first thing they've got to be taught is, you plant your field. With what? Would you want to use any seed of wheat, for instance, that we use today? You see, the restoration of all things, you can change that around a little bit and say the recreation of all things. Because we've totally polluted the seed, we've totally polluted the vines, the fig trees, and anybody that wants a good job and a good business in the millennium, get into gardening and do vines and fig trees, because everybody's got to have one. Small things. Deuteronomy 22, verse 8. Building regulations. And when you build a new house, you shall make a battlement or a guardrail for your roof, that you bring not blood upon your house if any man fall from hence. You see, because of the climate, the chances are most houses will have flat roofs. The flat roof becomes an entertaining area. It becomes a nice place to sit in the evening when the sun goes down after a hard day's labor and enjoy it. Because there's no severe weather. The weather is the right kind of weather at the right time. But you've got to make sure that it's safe. You don't want people falling off the roof. There's another scripture I read some time ago. It talks about if you've got a bull. Now, bulls at certain times of the year can get a little bit dangerous. And it says you've got to make sure that bull's fenced in a field, and that it's, you warn people not to go near this thing. Because if they go near it and they get gored, you are responsible. You see, it's all showing love for other people. That's what the whole basis of these rules are. Isaiah 5 verse 8 is another scripture. I think we all know this one. But when you start thinking about the ramifications of it, it changes everything. If you get nothing else out of this sermon than this, I will have succeeded. What's coming up will in no wise be anything like today. It will be totally different. This is Satan's idea as to how society runs. This is God's idea as to how it runs. Woe unto them, Isaiah 5 verse 8, that join house to house and lay field to field till there is no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. There are places in this country, we've got beautiful coastline, and you can't get to it because landowners own it and they won't let anybody through. It's mine. My personal beach, my personal lake. You can't fish in this river because I own the fishing rights. See, it's me, mine, mine, get off. These pop stars build themselves these ridiculous mansions in 400 or 500 acres and stick electric fences around and have security guards all going around because that's their little bit. Get off. It's mine. It's not God's way. You see, we don't want houses. We live on a house joined to a house. Fortunately, we're the end house. So we've only got a house on the one side of us. But you do get this feeling, having lived in other places where we had a house on, you know, fair, a quarter of an acre or so of land, and your neighbor's house was, you know, a couple of 100 yards away maybe. It's nice. You feel on your own. You've got your own place. And sometimes in England they build, I don't know how many, what's the latest now, 30 houses per acre?
250 apartments.
Human filing cabinets, 250 apartments on 1 acre of ground. Oh, dear, dear. Houses will be separate, but they will be in communities, unwalled villages. You'll have communities, but spaces between the houses. You will also have spaces between the fields to give people access through the land, to have areas for forestation, for the so-called wild animals to roam. But of course they won't be wild, will they? We talk about the lion, the lamb, and the wolf, and the bear, and all the rest of it. Their nature changes as well. Like I say, nothing's going to be the same. Nothing. Not one thing can you point to. I remember once in Sportsman's Club, this question came up many, 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 many years ago, when computers were just in their infancy. And I brought this question up as a table topic. You know, what part of this society could we possibly take into the millennium? Oh, and there was all sorts of wonderful ideas. This one guy got up and said, we've just simply got to have computers. And somebody else got up and said, what for? We've got hundreds of billions of galaxies. Each one's got hundreds of billions of stars. God calls them all by name. We can't even see them. He calls them all by name, and we're going to have the same mind. Who needs a computer? Bill Gates can retire. Mr. Bowles will rejoice because Microsoft will be dead and finished. He's trying hard not to cheer. But there'll be land in between fields. How do you treat other people's property in the millennium? Deuteronomy 22. You see, this is all based on love. Love towards God and love towards neighbor. Deuteronomy 22 verse 1. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep go astray and hide yourself from it. You shall not in any case bring them. You shall in any case bring them again to your brother. It's your duty. He's lost it. You found it. You take it back to him. And he said, if you can't find him, you hang on to it until you do find him. You look after it. You keep it. You keep it in good condition. Verse 5. Straight after that, it says, the woman shall not wear that which pertaineth to a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment. For all these things are an abomination to the Eternal. That's just after talking about taking your neighbor's ox or sheep or whatever back. It's just when you really need to think about going through these books and looking at these laws, because this is how God thinks. Verse 6, right after talking about the kind of clothes we wear, it says, if a bird's nest chance to be before you in the way and in a tree or on the ground, whether there be young ones or eggs, and the dam sitting on upon the young or upon the eggs, you shall not take the dam with the young. In other words, you can't take the eggs and the bird. You take the eggs. Because, I mean, some eggs people eat. I mean, like chickens. But, you know, who would slaughter and eat a hen that was, you know, giving you an egg every day? Silly. It's just the way you look after the creation, because that creation is feeding you. Deuteronomy 23, verse 24. Conduct. How do we farm? It says, when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, that you may eat the grapes to your fill. You're walking down past your neighbor's vineyard, and there's a lovely big bunch of grapes there. You can't probably pick the whole bunch because it's too big, but you can pull a chunk off and you go on down and eat the grapes. But it says you'll not put any in a vessel. Because you can't, that would be stealing. You see? If you take a basket down there and hack a whole bunch of grapes off and run back and make wine out of them, then that's stealing. But it's okay to eat a few grapes as you walk down the road. It talks about corn as well. Same thing with corn. And it says, when you beat your olive tree, and if you've ever seen them doing that, but to get the olives to fall, make sure they're ripe, they actually beat it with sticks. And the shaking of the tree causes the ripe olives to fall, and they just collect them up, and that's there. But there's a lot of green ones left. You had to leave those on the tree for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. See, God's system looks after everybody. Deuteronomy 25, verse 13. I'll just summarize it. It said, basically, if you're going to be measuring anything out, you make sure your weights and your measures are just. You can't have, it says you can't have two sets. It says, but you shall have a perfect, verse 15, Deuteronomy 25, verse 15, you shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure you will have. Not again a suggestion, yeah? The nature of animals are going to be changed. The lion is going to eat straw like an ox. It's got to be totally redesigned. A lion's gut could not handle straw, and a lion hasn't got the teeth to handle straw. It does pretty well at handling meat. Extremely well. Remember, some things are going to be totally destroyed. Totally, totally destroyed. Not a single fish in the sea. But turn to Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel 47, verse 10. And it shall come to pass that fishers shall stand upon the Dead Sea, as it is, from Engedi in the south to Engleam in the north. There shall be a place to spread forth their nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, plural, different kinds of fish, as the sea of the Great Sea, exceeding many. Now, by the Great Sea, I presume they're talking about the Mediterranean. This Dead Sea will no longer be dead. It will be full of fish. It looks like fish will be a very important part of the diet. Amos 9, verse 13. Amos 9, verse 13. Behold, the day comes, says the Eternal, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed, and the mountains shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. You see, this again points to a community. You have a bunch of people, they get together. They work together as a community. We have this today. You get an area. Not every single farmer has got a tractor and a shredder and a slicer and a grater and a sifter and all the other goodies they need to have to farm these days. They've each got bits and pieces. They share them, don't they? They go around. Yeah, I'll come and bale your hay. You come and do my whatever. That's the kind of cooperation. But you only get that today in the country. Because people in the country tend to have a little bit more, generally speaking, of an idea that there's a God out there because they live close to nature. They see it happening. They work with it. Not all, but much more so than in the city. And you get this cooperation. It's fantastic. But this is what it's going to be. Yeah, we're plowing your field tomorrow. Yeah, we're harvesting this tomorrow. And you guys better hurry up. They're getting that. We won't plow your field the day after. And they're saying, well, I haven't got it all in. Well, get going. Work a bit later. The abundance is going to be tremendous, and I think that superabundance will probably be used as things spread out from Israel to help those who are battling. But it won't be free gift aid. They'll get plants, they'll get seed to grow, and they'll be brought into under the rulership of Jesus Christ, and they'll be taught his ways. If you go into the Bible, you will notice that the Gentiles were never, ever, ever excluded from Israel. Never. There were a set of rules there to abide by. But the Gentiles could be assimilated into Israel. But he had to become an Israelite. The males had to be circumcised. They had to worship the God of Israel. They had to live by the laws of the land and the laws of God and so on. You see? See our mistake? We allow people from different nations, like in America now, there's a whole lot of Hispanic people. I didn't even realize they'd got almost up to the Canadian border. Taking up half the schools and insisting on being taught in their own language. Why? If you're going to live in America, well, become an American. Because that's why America was a great nation. Yes, it's a melting pot from all sorts of places. But you see, when people go in there and they want, this is what's happened here with our Muslim people, they keep their religion, they want their law. In fact, they want to impose their law on us. You see? Of course, God warned about all that and it's come to pass. You can read Psalm 128. Very short psalm, 6 verses. Blessed is he, everyone that fears the Eternal and walks in his ways. And if you just drop down, right down to verse 5, it says, the Eternal shall bless you out of Zion. And again, Zion, of course, is often referring to the church. And you shall see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Ooh, good of Jerusalem? Not today. I've been there several times, believe me. You just feel like you're living in a tinderbox that's liable to go up at any minute. Yes, you shall see your children's children and peace on Israel. Peace on Israel can only start at the millennium and go right on out, not before. Our job as kings and priests is to assist in the building of the family of God. That's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be assisting Christ to bring many sons to glory. Think about it. We're going to have the job of bringing these people through this 1,000-year period. And they'll have a goal. What's the goal today? Oh, that new Jaguar. Oh, if I won the lottery, boy, I'd have one of those British Racing Green mag wheels and so many electric gubbins. It'd take you 2 years to work out where the tea maker was. But that's the goal of people today. When people come into the millennium, one of the first things we're going to say to them is, do you want to be like me? That's going to floor them, isn't it? Because I was like you. I was like you. You can touch me. I'm solid. But after the sermon's given on the Sabbath, if I need to, I can just... And instantaneously, I can appear somewhere halfway across the universe. Because I am God. I have that power. They've got a goal. What would you do right now? If Jesus Christ stood here and said to you, do you want to be like me? But you see, that's what he's done, hasn't he? He's put that Holy Spirit in us. He's given us this opportunity. And what a fabulous opportunity we have as the first fruits. In the few minutes left, I'd like to go through that. Turn to Revelation 3. This is a scripture that, you know, I go over it and over it and over it, and every time I look at it, it makes you go weak at the knees. Revelation 3, verse 10. Because you have kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation. Where did we get the word of his patience from? Mr. Armstrong, his end time apostle. That's where that came from. Everything we know, the truth we've got, came through that one man. I also will keep you from the hour of temptation, which will come up to try them upon the dwell upon the earth. Physical protection at the end of this age. But there's a warning, verse 11. This is Jesus Christ speaking to every one of us. Behold, I come quickly. That hold that fast which you have. Let no man take your crown. Why? I firmly believe there is a set number of first fruits. And if people drop out, if they lose their way, somebody else is drafted in. There were 120 people at Pentecost, and yet 500 people saw the resurrected Christ, heard him teach. Well, this close to him, probably. But they weren't at Pentecost, were they? Because God's purpose was 120. The next couple of days, there were 5,000 people converted. because that was God's will. In Elijah's day, there were 7,000 that hadn't bowed the knee to Baal. That was God's will. You see, God's got a plan. It is all-encompassing. We've got the tremendous privilege of being part of that first fruits that will rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. Verse 12, him that overcomes, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. A pillar supports a building. Take a pillar out and it collapses. He shall go no more out. No more P45s, no more pink slips, no more redundancy, no more losing everything you've worked for all your life. Solid, secure, for eternity. And in the case of the first fruits, in the holy city, Jerusalem. Can you think of anywhere else you'd want to live? I will write upon him the name of my God. This is Jesus Christ speaking. The name of my God implies character and authority. In other words, we will take on that character. That's what we're working on now. We're learning to start thinking like God thinks, like King David thought. That's why we sing these psalms, because David was a man after God's own heart. We got to be thinking like this because we're going to have this character on us. We're going to have this name on us. And the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem. Wherever we go in this whole universe, whatever the universe is after the beginning, when the new heavens and the new earth are created, people will be able to look at us and say, he's got the authority of God the Father. He's got the authority of Jesus Christ. He comes from the holy city. Think about it. And there are going to be tens of billions of sons of God. This is talking to the first fruits. And Christ then says, I will write upon him my new name. If you want to make a note of Matthew 28, verse 18, to get some idea of Christ's new authority, and Jesus came and spoke unto them, saying, all power is given to me in heaven and on the earth. Wherever we go, we will have the authority of Christ, and all will see his character and the character of the Father in us. That's why, when we were at college, one of the buzzwords was, well, it's very character building. As you were pulling brambles up from under a forest, and you had 10 minutes to run about half a mile and get changed and be in a class. It's very character building. Turn to Joshua 23. I read this the other day, but I think it's very important. The more I read it again, the more it stands out. Because as I said the other day, the chocolate is on aisle 15. The alcohol is on aisle 17. And in the middle of the alcohol aisle, there's a door that leads out the exit. It leads out to the beginning. It is a sure floor plan. We have it. We've seen the first 12 aisles go past, the first 6,000 years. We can know that the rest of it's going to work. And Joshua carries this out in Joshua 23, verse 14. And behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. He was near death. And you all know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the eternal your God spoke concerning you. And all are come to pass unto you. And not one thing has failed. Double emphasis to make sure that they got the point. Everything God has promised us, we've had it. We've got it. Second Peter 1, verse 1. Peter understood this, and he left us a message. It's addressed to us. Simon Peter, a servant and an apostle of Jesus Christ, to them that have obtained like precious faith with us. 2,000 years ago, this was written, near enough. Who obtained precious, like and precious faith with us through the righteousness of God and our Savior Jesus Christ, grace and peace be multiplied unto you through the knowledge of God and of Jesus Christ our Lord. Again, where did that knowledge of God come from? According as his divine power has given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness. We have all things that pertain unto life and godliness. That's why we come together every year at the feast and we go over all these things, because if you don't, we just forget. That's just the way the mind is. We've got to be reminded every year. And every year we learn a little bit more. And every time you learn a little bit more, when you get some more knowledge, it goes with the knowledge you've got and you understand even more. That's why Bible study is so important. Have you ever had that feeling? You go into the Bible, you read that verse, and it didn't say that the last time I was there. Or I go on the Bible search, and I think it says so-and-so. I type that in, boom, blank. And after about 10 minutes, you think, oh, yes. And suddenly you think, oh, I didn't see that before. Because your knowledge has increased, your knowledge base has increased, therefore you understand even more. So the more the study, the more you study, the more you understand. And God needs that because that's what he's got to work with. If we don't understand his law, how could we administer it? That's why I think it's important that we read through some of these books and get some of the laws. I mean, God is interested in little birds, how we deal with little birds on the one hand and how we deal with nations on the other. His law is all-encompassing. 2 Peter 1, verse 4. And he says, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, the knowledge of what's beyond the chocolate. Yes, it's given to us. We know it's there because it's been right from the beginning. God's withheld nothing that he's promised. Whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these things you might be partakers of the divine nature. Nice old English. By these things you might become like God. The divine nature. To become kings and priests. To rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. And then on into eternity. But starting in the wonderful world tomorrow.